from Bright Umbrella, this is Control ClickCast. We inspect the web for you. Today, we're talking about using Statamic for large-scale sites with Daniel Fowler. I'm your host, Leah Alcantara, and I'm joined by my fab co-host,
Emily Lewis.
Today's episode is sponsored by Visual Chefs, a versatile web development agency with expertise in content management system and custom web application development. Through partnerships with designers, agencies, and organizations, Visual Chefs propels the web forward. Visit visualchefs.com to learn more.
Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to remind our listeners that we have a donate link on our site. So if you love Control Click and have a little spending money, consider donating to help us keep the show going. $1, $5, whatever you can spare will help us continue delivering great content, high quality audio, and transcripts for each and every episode. Now back to the business at hand. So large-scale sites have unique challenges and needs. Finding the right CMS to handle a mega site is critical. Today, we're talking with Daniel Fowler about using Statamic for a large-scale project, namely the University of Georgia's College of Education site. Daniel is a web developer specializing in architecting really big enterprise projects with more than 1,000 pages. He's been building higher ed sites for the past 7 years and also freelances on the side working on smaller sites for local businesses and nonprofits. Welcome to the show, Daniel.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you. Can you tell our listeners a bit more about yourself?
Yeah. So I am a triple dog from the University of Georgia. Not only did I get my business degree from there, but somehow they roped me into working there for 8 years. And I also served on the alumni board for a number of years. So I bleed red and black, as they say, and have definitely tried to sort of bring our website and things to a modern level. Woo!
Interesting. Wow. It's very rare for, you know, someone who doesn't have, say, a PhD track to stick around the university they went to school for. What made you decide to stay, especially with a business degree?
Right. Well, if you want me to be completely honest, it was necessity.
Ah.
Yeah. When I graduated, I couldn't find a job because I didn't know anything about business. I didn't know anything about development or professional industries of any kind. My parents, neither of them were business people and neither of them had anything to do with technology. And so when I graduated, it was difficult for me to figure out who these recruiters were recruiting my major, these big accounting firms and folks trying to recruit me to be what felt to me like a software developer. And I didn't know much about what I wanted to do with my life, but I knew I didn't want to be a software developer. So
interesting.
Yeah, so I began trying to just figure things out, and it was totally by chance and a God thing that I was in a musical theater production, and the director's father found out that I was a graduate from the Terry College of Business, and he, without knowing anything else about me, stepped up to bat and introduced me to about a dozen people at the university, one of whom eventually would hire me at the Terry College of Business where I graduated from. So it was there that I started as a part-time developer and then was hired full-time after about a year and a half. And the rest is kind of history.
That's nice. I always feel like it comes down to not only what you know, but who you know and, you know, the people who want to support you. Yeah, makes a huge difference. Well, and it's good you liked your alma mater.
Yeah. Well, you know, being here for 10 years, I've uncovered a lot of stuff that you never would guess as a student. But I imagine that's probably the case at any industry, but especially a public university like this.
Oh, yeah. You get to see behind the curtain.
Oh, yeah.
So since we're talking about the university level, you know, just in my mind, that naturally connotates a large site. Is that the case? Is there just one big site or are there many smaller sites? How does the structure of websites exist at the University of Georgia?
Yeah. If you think about the movie Independence Day, and they have all of those saucer ships that kind of hover over the major cities around the world and how big those things were. But then they discover that there's a mothership still out there in space that's, you know, exponentially larger. That's pretty much how a university website is structured. The big core is definitely almost unfathomable how big it is. But then the little offshoot websites, which we have over 100 of them just at the College of Education, are definitely very sizable in their little self-contained environments. So it's very convoluted. It's very spiderwebby. And you just kind of have to take it one step at a time.
Mm-hmm. I have to say, this is the best analogy ever. Independence Day with the chips. That's fantastic.
Well, it's true, though, Leia. We're also working with a university right now, and we're discovering right. that same sort of analogy where they have, you know, different programs that have their own sites that are maintained by
their department.
Its own department, right?
Yeah.
But then they're all sort of, at least in our case with this project, it's all in one massive large system, and they're just tiny sites running off of that one massive system.
Yeah.
Is that kind of how are your all your systems integrated, or are they all just tied together with, you know, branding and links, or are they actually running off this a same similar system?
Oh, man. I feel my blood pressure swell up just thinking about it. You mentioned two words in that one simple question that just made me go, oh, I wish. Oh, I wish. No, they do not talk to each other. The systems do not talk to each other. And then also the branding is a major issue. They are all over the place. Most of those offshoot websites I mentioned have no branding whatsoever. Mm. That links back to the mothership, the College of Education at the University of Georgia. So that's our major challenge right now is moving forward. I think the project we're talking about today is going to be just the pretty much the mothership that I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
We have yet to really tackle the hovering craft, if you will, those 100 offshoot websites, which are primarily in WordPress.
Mm.
Interesting.
So let's talk a little bit of generalities before we talk about specifics with the College of Education site. How do you define a large site? Like, what makes a large site a large site?
I think it's probably subjective, depending on who you ask. Mm. They'll have different things to say. I tell people that I specialize in mega sites, and I don't know if I'm the only person using that term or not. I know it's not an industry standard, but typically I define our large site by 1,000 pages or more,
mm-hmm.
which again, you tell somebody, it's so weird. It's a very lonely industry, web development, because you try to describe to my wife or to my parents or to even worse, my wife's parents, what it is I do and why I'm important. And they can't figure it out. Describing to them, you know, you have a website with over 6,000 pages, and when you rebuild it to only be 1,800 pages or 800 pages, they just don't really grasp it. They just nod their head and they say, yeah, wow. And you can tell it's just not clicking. So that's kind of where I draw the line, large site. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I work with a lot of local folks, and to them, a large site is anything above 50 pages.
Mm-hmm.
That's typically kind of a line I draw in the sand where I say, okay, you have a lot of content here, but you really have a pretty simple business model. So maybe we need to scale back.
Mm-hmm. So it's about, at least with your definition, it's about pages. Does anything else come into play that might, you know, maybe it doesn't quite hit 1,000, but it's got some other complexity that sort of combined with, let's say, 500 pages makes it a mega site?
Yeah, I deal with that on a regular basis trying to describe ours. And I imagine a lot of e-commerce sites deal with the same thing, where you can have a very simple site that's just your homepage and an About Us page, and then you have your product section that might be 500 products, but ultimately you don't really consider those a page of their own because there's only a little bit of content. So yeah, I definitely think page volume is one factor, but you're right, the complexity of the back end can very easily make a small site seem very big.
Mm-hmm.
So I would, from a developer side of things, I would say the number of templates that it takes to build something is probably our primary definition of what makes our site large.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a difference between just the general large site versus a large statamic site?
Maybe. To be honest, my background is in flat file static HTML websites, which is why I was drawn to statamic in the first place. And so I imagine if we tried to have this website in anything besides a flat file system, it would be just utter chaos. It's hard enough as it is to open a file directory, sort the contents by last opened or last edited, and, you know, kind of throw a benchmark where we say, okay, anything 3 years old or more or older, we get rid of. In a database-driven system, I imagine it's hard to sort content like that and do sort of a black and white categorical removal of old content. Hmm. So large static site might be a little bit more of a clear cut page volume. These are the number of files mm-hmm. we have on our server versus mm. CMS is more ambiguous. Well, no pages really truly exist on our site. And so roughly, you know, with search results and categories and things, you know, I don't know. What's the URL structure that works? Mm. Something along those lines.
Do you work with a team of people or are you solely responsible for this, the College of Education site?
I think it's a personal thing that I do. I always refer to our team, my team, when I'm talking to practically anyone. And I think I do that just because it gives me the feeling that I'm not alone.
Right.
When we were tackling the project, there was only a team of two of us. I was hired to come in and oversee the project. I had one team member that I inherited, and his development skills had not been really maintained by no fault of his own for the past 15 or so years, because he had been with the organization for 20 years and had a lot of organizational knowledge that was tremendous regarding the project and being able to move forward with certain clients. But at the same time, it was pretty much designed and built by me.
And do you have content authors that maintain content, or does that also fall to you and your teammate?
We do now. Originally, the structure that I've always followed at the university has been pretty much that program coordinators and department heads and faculty people. And if you're not in higher ed, maybe you don't know the difference between faculty and staff. Faculty are the professors and the academics. Staff are the support specialists, kind of the employees, the administrative assistants, the developers, the designers, folks like that. So typically, content is owned and edited by the program faculty. The thing is, they often say they don't have time to edit things. They don't like to write things for the web because they don't understand the web and how a website functions. And that makes total sense. So I drew up, one of the first things I did was draw up a schematic of what my team's makeup would be, which included content development editors. And so now we have two news writers who were hired as, you know, news writers for the college, but I was able to emphasize that I needed them to have a technology web-based skill set so that they could help just manage the content on the site, because I am not a content specialist. No one on my team is a content specialist, but we are able to use them now pretty much. I would say maybe 25 to 50% of their time is spent helping to update content, text, and pictures on our website, our big primary website.
Well, I was asking these questions because I'm curious, since you chose Statamic, are you having these content authors work directly with the files on the server, or are they managing things in the control panel?
They are managing things in the control panel simply because to give them the ability to upload a file to the server was going to be much more risky for non-developer types. And so we struggled a lot in the early going, because once we began using these content editors in the control panel, not only did that introduce some challenges with Statamic's members feature, because we have so many members, and I'll probably get to that later. But also we ran into some version control issues where they were editing on the live site in the control panel, and then the developers would be making changes and upload the file and overwrite some things. So we definitely had to overcome. I'd like to say we installed preventative measures before we had a real problem, but that's not the case. You learn by mistakes. We definitely had some deep breath, take a walk moments where things got overwritten. And finally, we got where we needed to be for now.
Okay. So I'm curious, because obviously I will talk about version control a little bit, you know, deeper. This brings the question, why did you decide to work on Statamic over other systems for this project, especially since it seems famously Jack McDade tried to dissuade you?
I couldn't believe that he did that. I thought he would be really excited that the University of Georgia was reaching out to use this, what I think at the time was almost a fledgling product. And so that was really exciting. But again, my personality is one that when I think I have a good idea and someone tells me that that it can't be done that way, that really, really motivates me to do it that way.
Sure.
So he said, you should probably check out something else. And I said, you know, I really don't have an interest in checking out anything else. I had a friend that told me about Statamic back in 2000 and I want to say early 2013.
Mm-hmm.
And I was hired by the College of Education at UGA in October 2013. So it was just within that year that I was told that I had a blank slate to build a brand new website for. They were currently using WordPress. I knew that I had previous experience with WordPress. I did not foresee it being a permanent solution. It's just not scalable for this size of a site,
mm-hmm.
not in my opinion. I'm sure several people would beg to differ, but ultimately, it was already built in WordPress, and I inherited it. I looked at it. You mentioned earlier that some sites kind of are built within themselves. Well,
right.
This site definitely had, I think it had 60 or 80 little subsites within its central WordPress implementation, and it was extremely hairy trying to mm-hmm. keep all those updated. The user management was a nightmare. The content was just awful. There were over 6,000 pages at that time. And again, those weren't pages that I could go see and feel.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned that my background is in static HTML development. And so ultimately, Statamic offered me what I was familiar with. Working with files, mm-hmm. I can choose whatever code editor I want to use. And as long as I have ready access to sync the server with what I have on my local machine, Statamic was what I wanted to do. So I guess the long and short of it is Jack said to try something else. I said, no, thanks. I'm going to make it work. You'll see. And here we are. I don't think we're the largest site using Statamic anymore, but that was something that I tried to promote ourselves as when we first launched.
Mm-hmm.
So, but again, going back to what really is a large site? Who knows?
I find this really interesting because we talk so much to people who are using database-driven CMSs,
right.
And it's not often that, you know, before I got into working with CMSs, like, yeah, I built static HTML sites, file-based, and worked with those. And, you know, you just don't hear that very often anymore. But I completely appreciate that, like, you embraced where you're strongest and where you felt you could make quick decisions. And, you know, I think that's what it comes down to. We had a listener write in, and the long and short of her question is, what do I look for in a CMS to make my life easier the next time I have to, you know, work with it, especially coming from some other CMS? And I think you kind of answered it. You pick something that you can get the job done in. I mean,
Yeah. There
are other factors for sure, but that's a huge one.
Yeah, I am where I came from at the Terry College Business. We had just launched a new website that was built in Expression Engine.
Mm-hmm.
I was not the lead developer on that, and I didn't know anything about Expression Engine when that project started. And so I went online and started reading the documentation, watching the video tutorials, and learning, you know, what Expression Engine was all about. I turned around to try and apply my newly acquired knowledge to our implementation, but it had been so customized that nothing I learned was really applicable. It didn't look the same. It didn't function the same because it had all of these, you know, Expression Engine developers probably love this, but, you know, we had dozens of add-ons and plugins that really changed the core functionality of the system.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something I'm really big on, always trying to use the system's core strengths to the maximum capacity and customize as little as possible. And again, that probably comes because I've worked on really, really, really big sites. And so I know standardization is of the utmost importance.
Mm-hmm.
And to roll into an upgrade in the future is really, really difficult to do when it's severely customized.
So I'm really curious about, you know, once you've decided on Statamic and you're like, okay, I'm going to go through all of this, how did the planning process go? Did you do some sort of audit? Did you create a spreadsheet? Like, I'm just trying to figure out what your planning process over, okay, here's what Statamic offers, here's what we need, how do we combine the two?
You know, unfortunately, I didn't get much of a whole planning phase like that. When I came in October, I spent the first couple months trying to, you know, get the lay of the land. Like any new organization, you have to figure out who the people are, who the key players
right.
are, who your staff is, how things operate, what are the procedures that are in place. And in January then of the following year, when I finally sat down and said, okay, it's time to start building something new. I think I've gotten enough of the big picture. The dean then told me that I had 7 months to do it. And so I originally had drawn up a timeline that was 12 to 15 months.
Right.
And again, this, the old site had 6,000 pages on it. And when he told me that, we kind of said, well, we had better get cracking. And so really, I didn't have a lot of time to evaluate whether or not it was going to work. But I knew that even a static HTML site that we had total control over mm-hmm. was going to put the college in a better position than a WordPress site that had all these kinds of plugins and add-ons mm-hmm. that no one really knew how to use and that were broken in certain areas, but not in only a few areas, many areas. And so trying to make sense of the mess that was there already was going to be much more burdensome than just saying, we're going to do this. We're going to keep it basic. We're going to build whatever we can using minimal infrastructure. And then we can grow from there mm-hmm. instead of trying. I even overstepped that a little bit because I tried to implement some features that I thought the college would love, that the faculty would be like, this is wonderful. But what I discovered is that the faculty were so ingrained in the way things were done that even my really cool new features like a central calendar, which was brand new to the website when I came along, even those really took several months after the initial launch to catch on because people just weren't used to having it.
Mm-hmm.
It really wasn't until this the past few months even that the calendar has really taken off. If you go to our calendar now, you see about 30 events in October, which is still probably only about half the number of events we actually have going on. But it was just really incredible that things didn't go the way I foresaw. Mm-hmm. So sorry, I ramble a lot in case you didn't figure that out. But ultimately, the planning phase had to get cut out. I drew up this whole project life cycle and explained, you know, these are the tests that we need to undergo. We need to do the research, the information gathering with the stakeholders and everybody. And to an extent, we did those things. But as far as weighing the pros and cons of an information infrastructure, we weren't really afforded that opportunity. So I had decided that Jack challenged me to do it in Statamic, and I was going to do it in Statamic.
You know, I appreciate you saying this type of story because mm-hmm. sometimes, you know, you go to conferences and we have these presentations where everything is ideal.
Right.
You know, as in you get all the content at once, force your client to give you the content. So great. And, you know, like, here's all our perfect wireframes from our perfect timeline of our perfectly paid, you know, project, you know, life cycle. And the reality is that you and a lot of us listening out here have different timelines, different bosses, different priorities. And it's not because we didn't, you know, like you mentioned earlier, you had a 12 to 15 month timeline. It's not like you weren't aware that for a specific vision that you had that it would need more time. But if the dean says 7 months, then certain things need to get cut.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the reality. Are you going to like start arguing with the dean at this point? Which, I mean, in some ways as a professional, there are points in time where you do need to have those difficult conversations and you have to argue. But at other times, it's like, you know, if something needs to launch in 7 months, then we just need to figure out what can we do in those 7 months.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I could talk about that project for days, and I'm going to get to, because I'm attending some conferences here in the next couple months where I'm presenting.
Perfect.
So I'll try not to go into too much detail here unless you want me to. I certainly can. But yeah, that's absolutely true. Choosing your battles became an integral part of how we functioned. And now that I've given some context, you kind of see how the one team member that I did inherit, his organizational knowledge was critical because mm-hmm. I had to say, we're moving forward. I'm sorry, but we're moving forward. And he was able to navigate those client relationships with a little bit of finesse that I just didn't have the time for.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So now that you've had time, you know, from your initial, I'm going to make Statamic work mindset, now that you've worked with it, have you discovered any surprising strengths that it offers for this type of large site that you suspect is better than what you know, some of the other options you could have looked at?
Absolutely. I would say number one is the speed. because right. it's a flat file built yep. and you don't have to ping the server a dozen times. That's really nice. At the same time, we have so much content in our navigation and in our footer that we are pinging the server more often than probably a much smaller site would do or a much more streamlined site. But I think that's just the nature of higher ed, not so mm-hmm. much Statamic. Statamic, I think, is handling that much better than would a database-driven CMS, given the same parameters that we're working with regarding the industry and our content.
Mm-hmm.
So not to mention, I mentioned earlier, we have these little sub one-off sites. We have about 100 of those. Most of them are built in WordPress, and they all, the people that those were built for control their own content, going back to that question.
Mm-hmm.
And that means they're also responsible for maintaining their navigations and their menus and populating the content there. And in WordPress, that requires a lot of technical training that you have to go through with a person for that.
Mm-hmm.
With Statamic, what I have found is that I cheat a little bit. I use editing the homepage because the homepage is pretty much completely dynamic. It pulls all of its information from other parts of the website. So for our content editors, I use the homepage to set up a lot of the variables that they need to edit things in the navigation and in the footer. So if you go to edit things on the homepage in the control panel, you don't actually see content that's on the page. You see header navigation, you know, and you can add and remove items from that. And then you see footer menu, and you can add and remove social media links and university resources that are down there. And so it's really helpful. Again, taking that core basic functionality of the system
mm-hmm.
and finding, I guess, I don't consider it to be that creative, but finding a creative way to use it. Instead of going and looking for an add-on that will accomplish the same thing that someone might have envisioned without trying to think outside the box.
So it's like you're using your homepage to store global information.
Pretty much, because that is one thing with Statamic. Global variables are possible, but as far as I know, they're kind of only possible for now for developers. And so you have to get into the file and edit global variables versus allowing the content editors to make changes in the control panel. I think with version 2, which Jack and his team are working on, I think maybe global variables are making it into the control panel, but I'm not entirely sure.
Well, I did something similar myself with a Statamic client. You know, I just converted a page that actually wasn't a content page to hold global information that would show up in different places on the site.
Yep.
And, you know, it just, from a content author standpoint, it kept his workflow the same as it is across the board. You know, I just trained him. I'm like, on this page, this is what you do for your global stuff. And done, you know, yeah. straightforward right. and simple. And you're right. I think that's you know, just to reiterate, you've said it a couple times, but I think it's worth saying again, especially for our listener who is asking, her name or his name is Darby Dixon, with regard to choosing another site and what you should look for. I think having that core functionality and having a creative approach to leveraging the core really helps you create that foundation that you don't have to worry about the complexity of an upgrade later when you have dozens of add-ons in place. So with regard to you mentioned earlier, you had a few issues with version control. When we talked with, I think, Jack for the first episode that we had about Statamic, you know, one of the things that really appealed, you know, just to me in general about Statamic was that we weren't dealing with the database. And so we could version control everything, which is super nice because having to deal with bringing the database into the version control workflow is a bit cumbersome.
Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about the challenge you had and what you did to resolve that for Statamic with version control?
Yeah, we were, oh man, the university, the university as a whole, to be completely frank, has been really backwards with its web resources, but its technology resources also. They upgrade in chunks and certain pieces. So when I came to College of Education, I mentioned I wanted to get the lay of the land first with procedures and things. Well, there was almost nothing for me to really grab a hold to. No protocol to follow, procedures to follow. I walked in at a time where those things were being defined and created for the very first time for this organization. So yeah, version history, version control was one of those things. And so we walked into a situation where there was none happening. And the first thing I wanted to do was figure out what Git was all about, because that was something as a static HTML person, I probably mm-hmm. should have known about Git 10 years ago. But because higher ed is so far lagging behind private industry and development, oh, that's a soapbox that I want to chase right now. But I'm not going to. And oh, I want to. Maybe we'll circle back. So I had to figure out what that was all about. And I actually started looking for a developer to hire who specifically on the job description, I said, I want this person to manage our Git repos. Mm-hmm. Because I didn't really understand them a whole lot. And I was so focused on the redesign that I only had a limited amount of time to actually figure it out. And right. For someone walking into that for the very first time, it's very difficult. So luckily, a few months ago, maybe several months ago by now, I'm not sure, Jack and the Statamic team did roll into the core functionality of Statamic of a revision history feature, which was really nice. We actually turned that on about a month and a half ago, and it's been wonderful. But before that, for the past year or so now, we have been using Git repos so that on the developer side, as we make changes to the files, we sync them to the repo for our backup copy, and then we also sync it to the server. Originally, we were doing an automatic synchronization so that as we pushed things, committed things up to the remote repository, we would sync it over to the server just automatically. We didn't have to do that extra step, but ultimately right. we realized that we wanted to keep a better tab on the changes that were being made. And sometimes we were, in the wrong branch making changes, and then all of a sudden it was synced over to the server, but we weren't ready for it to be synced over. So we made that disconnection. And so now it's in our workflow where our repos are pretty much our backup copy. And okay. we just sync up and down to the server using FTP.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And then from the content editor side, they have the version history, the Statamic revision history plugged in. And we also have a daily script that we run that our developer built, that every morning it runs a script that downloads new content from the server and commits it to our repo.
Mm.
So I don't know if I described that very well, but we have now version control happening on the developer side and on the content editor side.
Mm-hmm,
so it's a twofold process for us, which is really, really nice, because that situation I described to you earlier where we overwrote server files that the editors had worked on because right. the developers were unaware. Now we have the opportunity to roll back. If an editor overwrites something a developer has done, the developers, we have our backup system we can pull from. And if we overwrite something the editors have done, we can go into the Statamic version control and pull that revision out. So far has been working really nice for us over the past couple months. We have had a couple of incidents arise where something got overwritten and we had to go find the correct version of the file and sync it back up.
I'm glad you described that, because I think it's easy to forget that, like, Leigh and I, we do version control with the two of us. And if we're dealing with a client who has a single point of contact for the CMS and they're the only person that's maintaining content and all that other stuff, then it's sort of easy to bring them into that workflow. But the instant you're dealing with a team of content editors,
mm-hmm.
it increases the complexity of what version control needs. And it really never occurred to me until you described it today that Statamic would also have those issues, because you do have the making changes in the control panel and you have making changes on the files. And those two, I think that's useful to describe, because I think I made an assumption that, oh, just be like, super simple version control because you're just dealing with flat files. Well, not if you have a team of 20 people editing content from the control panel.
Right.
Well, the other thing that I was thinking about too, a benefit between a flat file system versus a database is, I know for us, there's always a content pause situation
mm-hmm.
whenever you have to do a database sync between like local development and live servers. With this type of system, does that also occur where you're like, okay, we're going to be pushing stuff up? Or is it not, like, do you tell people like, okay, we're going to do this between 12 to 1 p.m. this lunchtime. Better not edit anything.
During our redesign and right around the launch time, we definitely did a lot of that. We came to an agreement with the content editors that after 4 o'clock, they were hands off. and the development team was going to be making site-wide, or had the opportunity to make site-wide changes. Now that we're kind of in a day-to-day maintenance mode, kind of, if you want to see it that way, but we're still in the redesign mindset. We've only just finished the mega redesign. Now we're doing all the little mini projects on the areas that got neglected during the redesign. So that's a whole different thing. But yeah, what we do now is that we have a chat room service that we use, HipChat, around the office. And so everybody, what I do about every other week or so, I throw a message in there that says, is anybody working? I need to do something site-wide. And so I need everyone to, you know, finish what you're doing and let me know when you're backing off of it. Mm-hmm. And so once I get the all clear from the four people around me, then I go in and will download everything from the server, or download the content that might have changed on the server, make sure I have the most current version, make the changes I need to use. That, again, is something I love to do since my background is in static HTML. Search and replace is something I'm just pro at. And so I love doing search and replace across the entire site for something and then uploading those files to the server. So that's been really handy, but it might not be the most efficient, but that chat room especially then becomes a referential archive for saying, no, I clearly said this was happening. Sorry.
Right.
You know, these are all the workflows that you have to, I think the minute you deal with a larger site, whether it's large in terms of number of pages or large in terms of the people involved who have their hands in it, your workflows, you have to come up with these sort of, all right, 4 p.m., this is when you're going to stop and we're going to use this. And, you know, maybe it doesn't seem efficient, but it gets the job done. You know, you have to do that stuff. We did that recently with, again, it's a higher ed client that we're working with, and we took like hours to define like the workflow of how they were going to, you know, when we told them to pause content and what they should be doing and when we would come back in, just to make sure, you know, just to cover our butts and to give them as much information as we could before we actually started doing it. And I'm not sure it was the most efficient approach, but it got the job done.
Yeah, no, and you have to do what you have to do. We, we're still struggling with documenting procedures because they get defined kind of on the fly. And so we kind of forget to write them down from time to time. We use Basecamp all the time. I love Basecamp. But there's sometimes stuff that I remember having a conversation about it. And I know we made a decision that that's what we were going to do. But then I can't find confirmation in email or in Basecamp or anywhere. And so I have to sit down with them again and say, okay, this is our procedure. I'm documenting it here in Basecamp, like a source that we can all access, and then use it as a guideline going forward.
I definitely think that this is, well, I mean, documentation and all this communication and everything is important for all clients, big or small, but especially for large sites and larger clients, this type of communication, like making sure you really document things, is very unique to like super large site.
I think it's also worth mentioning, and I'm not sure where budget comes in with your role, Daniel, but you know, when we're working as an agency with a large client, we increase our project management hours because there's so much extra communication. There's so much extra documentation because we're dealing with a team of 15 people versus one person. And that's just 15 for that one department. You know, that's not all of the departments that are involved.
Right. Man, I wish I could charge for the amount of overhead that we experience. Unfortunately, I am my services are free to those that choose to use them within these walls, at least. That's why I freelance on the side. I have to supplement my income. No, but you're absolutely right. Communication is a big deal to me, both professionally and personally. And I could, again, talk about that for half a day. It just comes up over and over again. I just went on a vacation a weekend getaway with my wife and her parents. And they wanted to stay with us the first night of the weekend. And she failed to mention to them that we did not have a guest room. And so they kind of showed up expecting, you know, to have a bed and stuff. And we had an air mattress laying on the floor. And we're like, okay, there was a miscommunication that happened here. And that happens, you know, in different contexts around the office all the time. And I'd like to say that my team is impervious to that. But, you know, we have graphic designers, news writer, and, well, okay, single graphic designer, a couple of news writers, and a couple of developers who need to be talking to each other about the projects we work on, but we don't regularly. We're pretty good about chatting in HipChat about things, but you're absolutely right. Communication channels have got to be wide open. That was actually, if I can chase a rabbit for a sec, that was actually a big thing for us during the original redesign of that 6,000 page website. I came in and it was explained to me that the college had some major communication issues and that we needed to be as transparent as possible, communicating to the faculty, 400 something faculty and staff in the college, making sure that everyone was aware that a change was coming. And so we pushed it out in the bi-weekly newsletter, and that's twice weekly, not like every other week, twice weekly newsletter. We were pushing out information as the project progressed. I built a blog that I maintained throughout the project. I emailed department heads from time to time with information. And still, when we launched after that 7 months, there were so many people that just screamed bloody murder because they had no idea. And so you expect information to trickle down, and it does not trickle down, especially in an organization this large. We have about 450 or so faculty and staff. It just does not flow the way you expect it to. You think people are going to be excited with you when a new product is coming, a new website's coming. But the truth is, they're off in their own worlds doing their own things. They're teaching classes. They're doing that. If they're designing logos, they're designing logos. And you have to kind of pull people out of their own little world, out of their own little silo, and make them understand.
And to kind of piggyback on that comment, I think not just to, you know, pull them out of their silos, but make sure they understand that on some level, all the silos need to know that the other silos exist. For example, we had a we finished up a project with this higher ed client, and we had like a, I don't like the word postmortem, I like the retrospective. So we sort of looking back on what went right and what went wrong. And we found out, you know, after the project launched that they had a bunch of other things going on that we didn't even know about. And it's not that it necessarily affected us directly, but it did affect the launch to some degree. And us knowing that the team members that we're working on for this site were also working on this other project, sort of tangentially related, but not, you know, specifically related, would have been helpful for us, you know, so that we weren't like, why haven't we heard back or what's going on here?
Right.
You know, they didn't think to tell us because it wasn't part of the website, but it was related to some degree, even just from an asset allocation, you know, where resources, time were.
And see, I think that's what separates me a little bit from a typical developer, especially in higher ed. It's kind of rare that you encounter a higher ed, a public university with a web team, especially a college within the university, that has a manager. I'm the first web manager that the College of Education at UGA has ever had. And so what separates me, not only being in that position, but also because I have a business degree, I come at things from a business process perspective. I want to know what the goals are so that I can problem solve the best solution to get there. A lot of people come to me with a solution that they want and they don't know anything about websites. And so they say, we need this. And I say, okay, can you tell me what you're doing this for? And then they get defensive. And so that's really difficult to deal with. And I honestly think that that'll be something that, at least in higher ed, that we deal with forever.
Well, I think there's always a disconnect between technology and academia, at least thus far.
I think any large organization, though, in general, because I think the larger the organization, the more set in their current ways they are, especially like government, for example, is probably quite similar in terms of red tape, communication issues, and like how long it takes for them to even, you know, upgrade a small part of their site.
Ultimately, we are a government. Public, as a public university, we are state funded, and that is where most of the political red tape exists, is because we can't just do things. I imagine if we were a private university, maybe the web team could charge for their services, almost like literally an internal kind of consulting group that charges departments to use us. I think that would be a great business model, especially since universities are increasingly being run more like businesses. I think that's laying the foundation of potentially seeing more of those kind of charges for services, just so that departments understand that when value. They make a request, mm-hmm. yeah, it's costing something. And if they want to increase the scope of a project midway through, it's going to take more time and it's going to take more money.
I want to circle back towards some specific Statamic questions or technical questions, actually.
Yeah, so
so we talked about the version control stuff. The other major things that I want to make sure we talk about before the show ends are the security concerns and backup options
we have
for
a
Statamic. Okay, so let's talk about security concerns. What kind of concerns would you have for a site as large as this?
Well, I don't know how much I'll be able to say about this because I don't know who's going to listen to this. Well, I think it's important to know. But okay,
right.
We don't have a lot of external security concerns. We hardly have any at all. I think as a flat file system, server permissions mm-hmm. and robot text files and things go a long way of reducing the ability for hackers to get in. Maybe I'm inviting hackers to attempt now that I said that, but I don't know. It'd be interesting to see. I think most of the holes come in other university applications that are not as secure web apps that people use, because we do have a university central system for authentication. And so that's kind of like, if there's a small hole into there, you get access to all kinds of stuff. But our issues with Statamic is just kind of one thing. And I'm given to understand it's going to be resolved with version 2, but that is from a content editing standpoint. Currently, the membership roles are not very diverse. And so you either have to give a member access to the control panel or not. And so Jack and his team have said that more member roles are coming with version 2. So we're really excited about that because, again, I have two content editors that I want to have kind of full access to the website to edit things. But then everyone else, because we have them set up as members to let them populate their own information on their profile, that creates a security risk, because if they knew that they were at the same level as those content editors, as far as access to the control panel, they might decide they want to go and edit their own pages.
Right.
Especially on a bad day when I've told them no to something. they might decide they want to do it themselves. And they might do it wrong and then create some havoc. I don't think anyone would do something like that maliciously, but accidental is definitely a big risk. I had to mm-hmm. put in some just basic style rules so that if someone was logged in and on the control panel and they were not one of the four people that should be able to edit anything, they just simply don't see those tabs in the control panel to go look at the web content. They only see the tab that says, edit my profile, and that's all they see. But that's purely CSS.
Oh, nice. That's clever. I like that. That never even
it's
occurred
a simple
to me. Yeah, but I like
solution.
That. I could easily implement that for the Statamic site we've got running right now with the client, just because when I was doing the training, he's like, what's that tab for? I'm like, don't touch that.
Don't touch.
Now just hide. Yeah, just hide it.
Right. Don't let them see it or they will ask questions.
So we talked a bit about security. Let's talk about backups. What sort of protocols do you have in place to, you know, protect the information on the site?
Really, the only thing we have is those version control systems that we talked about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
We had a separate thing. It wasn't web related. A problem came up where we just rolled out our big annual report, which is a big printed publication that we do every year. And as it was about to need to go to the printer, our information technology office decided to do some system upgrades over the weekend, which ultimately erased the past 2 weeks of data that had occurred on this shared server drive. And so that was not very exciting for that whole team that was involved in that project. But that is another area where we have a shortcoming, and I don't know how widespread it is within higher ed, but a backup, like an offsite backup of server content, server files, server configurations is not something that we have, but that we need. So like I said, we have a twofold version history that we can pull from to preserve our changes. But if plan A fails and then plan B fails, we're kind of back where we were 9 months ago when we had none of it to begin with.
Now, when we're dealing with a flat file system, Is there any need for any kind of caching? Because at least with my experience, limited experience with caching, it's caching database queries. Yeah. So like you were describing how a very complex navigation or in the footer, like those are can be huge database query hogs. And so those would be typical things that we would cache. Is there anything with Statamic or the flat file system that you do need to do some type of caching?
Yeah. Statamic has this great little feature called HTML caching. That was another feature that, you know, they didn't have when we originally began working on the redesign, but that came later. And so, you know, when they introduce a new feature and I'm drowning in a massive project like the one we tackled, I don't have a lot of time to evaluate the new features that are coming out.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't think anything of it. We launched the site. A month or two into it, the dean noticed that the site felt slow to him. When the dean notices that the site feels slow to him, you take steps to make it faster. So we investigated. I knew that they had this caching feature. I turned it on, and it was wonderful. Pages that were taking 6 to 8 seconds to load began loading in under a second.
Wow.
And it was fantastic until we realized the side effects, which is where I mentioned that we introduced a master calendar of sorts.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, our little event feeds on pages here and there were cached as, you know, September 21st. And so September 29th came along and that page still showed the past events from the past week. So that became a real problem. Content on the homepage, especially, we get 3 million page views a year, 300,000 users touch our site every year. The homepage itself gets, I want to say 750,000 page views a year. And so very, very high traffic looking at a homepage where it says upcoming events. And none of the events are upcoming.
Mm-hmm,
and
right.
So that was a big, big, big issue. I had to turn off HTML caching for that reason. And we have not reactivated it because we streamlined the site in other ways, such as making the navigation smaller. I had a lot of dynamic content in the navigation. So, you know, you would pull down the dropdown that said news and it would populate with the latest news articles and really cool stuff. But I took all that out. So we just had static navigation. And that helped speed us up a lot.
So the HTML caching, it's sort of site-wide or system-wide. You can't specify it for individual elements or pages?
You probably can customize it. At the time, again, it was just me and another guy.
Mm-hmm,
and
right.
We didn't have the time to really investigate it. We just had a problem on our hands that had to be rectified. So we are finally now in a season where that's the kind of question we need to circle back to and reevaluate. Mm-hmm,
right.
But at the same time, we're running a site now that speed is not an issue. So even without HTML caching turned on, we're kind of good to go.
Okay. Well, what happened between things were loading between 6 seconds, turned on the HTML caching, it went quickly. That made things mucky. Then you turned it back off. Like, so was the 6 second thing resolved?
Yeah, it was. And that kind of goes back to the question of what defines a large site. Because we have about, depends on, you know, how you do the page count, we have upwards of 1,900 pages on our site today, right now. However, that is 400 pages that are dynamically generated from the member files that I talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And we have over 400, we're probably up to close to 500 now, news articles that are constantly being published. You know, we publish 5 of those a week or so. So what happened is where I had that dynamic content, we also have 400, 500 events in the calendar. And so if you strip all those, just those three areas out, our site size is only about 800 pages. But because those are three areas that I wanted to speckle throughout our site, especially in the navigation, when I had that dynamic content pulling 400 news articles just to display 4 of them, that was very resource intensive. So when we took those things out, we've got really basic information on the pages and the resource expense is nothing. The biggest resource taxation we have is just the volume of users that are looking at our site spikes every day. People love looking at our Google Analytics on a daily basis because in higher ed, it's very wave-like. On the weekends, it dips off real bad. And then Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, it spikes and it's very, very, very cyclical, seasonal.
Do you do any caching or specific things to deal with those spikes?
No. It's mostly dependent on the university bandwidth for the actual ability to flow in, like the hardware, physical ability to flow information in and out of campus. And that's one of those areas I was alluding to earlier that in the past, our network has not been up to snuff. When Netflix became a big thing and YouTube exploded, the university was very slow to catch up to those needs because of that increased need for bandwidth. The dorms, mm-hmm. I mean, we have thousands of students living on campus right. who are using internet for daily things, daily regular mm-hmm. things. And luckily, the university, instead of blocking those sites, took them 10 or 12 years, but they finally improved the infrastructure so that it could handle it.
I think one of my favorite things about this episode is that the solutions that you're coming up with are simple. And, yes. you know, like not having the navigation be dynamic. That's a simple solution to an important problem when it comes down to like speed and performance, especially if the dean is the one who's pointing it out to you.
Yeah.
Well, then, you know, just change that feature a little bit to not be exactly, you know, what you had it before. It's still just, you know, I'm sure you still have a link to the news articles. Yep. It's just not, you don't see the latest four.
Right. We do still have that on the homepage. Another little trick that I learned is that if you don't want to pull 400 or 500 events into mm-hmm. a feed just to display a few of them, you can leave that up to a content editor who periodically, every week or so, goes into that site and defines what three or four news articles. This is what we did on our homepage. We had four slots for news articles. And so they started going in to the homepage and selecting the mm-hmm. four articles that they wanted to feature. And that would swap out every 2 weeks or so. So we were still pulling a list, but we could say specifically, don't pull all 400, just pull these four.
So I want to make sure we address some of our listener questions. I already mentioned that Darby Dixon had asked about choosing a CMS and working with an unfamiliar CMS like Statamic. And I think really the simple answer for that is if you have experience in a CMS, you have some knowledge from which to evaluate other systems. You can say, you know, is it something I'm familiar with? Does it need add-ons? Those basic questions. But I do think that we should kind of circle back to one of our first questions to answer some questions that Addison Hall submitted. He was curious, when Jack had told you not to use Statamic, did he point out any specific things that he thought you might encounter that would be problematic? And
yeah.
if so, did any of those problems actually occur?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He was right about everything. But I chose to take the plunge and I've never looked back. Even hiring developers and people asking the question, why didn't we go with WordPress since the site was already in WordPress? Why didn't we use Expression Engine? Because that's one that Jack specifically mentioned that I should look at. I informed Jack that I wasn't particularly fond of Expression Engine. And so, yeah, he specifically mentioned membership, which, as I already mentioned, has been one right. of our major sticking points. We're doing membership in a very special way in that we want our faculty and staff to be able to edit their own profile, but that's all we want them to be able to edit. We don't mm-hmm. want them to edit content about a degree program. We want them to just be able to edit pieces of information on their profile. Statamic does have a front-end form tag pair that you can use for editing a member profile. However, mm-hmm. in my, I think, two or three times, I tried to implement that and ran into the fact that it just couldn't handle the complex field types that we had employed mm-hmm. in our member profiles. So in other words, we have tables of information being created in the member profile to display education backgrounds for our folks. So they input, you know, the university that they attended, the degree they got, the year they graduated, what their concentration was, things like that, that are a grid field type in Statamic. But the front end HTML form that they had could not handle taking user input from, you know, just a collection of input variables and translating it into a grid on the back end. So because of that, we've never rolled out a front end solution. Instead, I took the CSS hack approach for the control panel. So yeah, he warned me about these things and they were definitely our major sticking points, but we've managed. I haven't ever regretted choosing Statamic over Expression Engine, which was the closest thing that we had to a plan B, because I was not going to use WordPress. That was for sure. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's been a delight as long as... The other thing is that I'm a very patient person. I am so dedicated to the minimalist approach mm-hmm. that I'm willing to wait for the features to be implemented versus demanding that they come now. And if it can't do it, I'm going to go find an add-on that will do it.
Mm-hmm.
So if I can't do it and they tell me that, oh, that's a good idea, maybe we'll have that in 6 to 8 months, I say, okay, I'll figure out some other way to do it for now. And mm-hmm. we'll tackle it later.
So you're not using any add-ons for Stativic?
Man, I wish I could say that. We are using Raven, which with version 2 is going to be baked in.
Okay.
We're using Bloodhound, but not for our primary search. That's only for our intranet, which is a sticking point for internal faculty and staff. Our intranet is not publicly Google searchable.
Yeah.
So it's not publicly findable, but the pages do not require a login. So it's not a password protected area, but it is a non-searchable area from Google. So we have Google search implemented on our site that cannot crawl our intranet. Instead, I employed Bloodhound Search, a Stativic first party add-on for the intranet search. And that has, you know, again, solved that issue. That's more of an internal issue. That's not a system issue at all. They have Bloodhound Search that we could use for the whole thing if we wanted to. But Google, everybody loves Google. Well, not as much as I think they used to, but it works for us, and I don't want to mess up what people are used to, which is Google.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
So anyway, what add-ons are we using? We're using those two, and then we're using a calendar add-on, which again is going to be baked into version 2. And that was a Jason Varga add-on that I mentioned. We hired him as a freelancer. He was going to build that calendar add-on for us, and then it was in his contract that he was going to be able to resell it. But again, his contract took so long to approve that he had already built it and started selling it before he started working with us. So he helped us implement it, and we're still using it. Those are the only three add-ons we're using.
Is this the calendar that he's got on pixelfear.com?
Yes.
Okay, great. We'll make sure to include that in the show notes.
Yeah, the only thing that the calendar add-on is really doing for us is giving us a nice little monthly view of the events. We have a little calendar element that's really pretty, and that's really the only thing it's doing. The actual functionality of a calendar as far as listing events and having feeds throughout the site is all handled with core Stativic functionality.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Very cool. Well, I feel like we can continue talking about this for a long time.
Oh, man.
But I'd like to know before we wrap up what your best advice is for anyone planning a large site, especially a larger site on Stativic.
Yeah, you have got to get clear, decisive buy-in from the people above you, especially the top, which is going to be difficult because they are not tech savvy. And if you're in a situation like I am with no budget and, you know, limited team and everything like that, it's going to be very difficult to put together a flashy presentation like the vendors will be able to, who will come in and say, let us do this for you. So it's really difficult. When I arrived, I was told I had a blank slate, and that was very, very helpful. Everyone told me that. I have three levels of bosses all the way up to the dean. And they each told me that we were starting from scratch, blank slate, build it the way it needed to be built. So that was extremely helpful. The timeline was not very helpful, but the ability to just ignore what we had at the time and build it following best practices and web standards was tremendous. So that's definitely one thing, especially with a large site. The other thing I would say is communication. Even though we didn't get the word spread the way we wanted to, the way we thought it was going to spread initially. I mentioned we had a blog and we had a newsletter and all these different ways we were reaching out to people to let them know that this was coming. They still didn't get the idea. They still didn't know. But what we had was a multi-layered paper trail where we could go back and say, I'm sorry you're upset, but if you look at all these things we sent, if you were reading the newsletter, you would have known. If you had checked your email and, you know, actually paid attention to that one that said big and important web update, you would have known. So have a paper trail. Make sure you're communicating clearly about the scope and how things are working, because in a project this big, actually, that's going to be my number three. Number three, in a project this big, it's very difficult to see the finish line. And so I think I'm particularly skilled at being able to wrap my head around a big picture, but communicating that to my team for day-to-day to-do items is very difficult. So what you need is the ability to paint the big picture for later, but keep your team focused on the here and now. You have to set those mini deliverables to accomplish the large deliverable. And so following your life cycle to a T, making sure that anyone that starts to sort of steer a meeting discussion towards, well, I don't know if we can do this design because when we develop it, it's not, whoa, time out. We're not talking about development right now. We're talking about design. And before we talk about design, we talk about content. And so making sure people are just focused on the mission for this phase and then sort of guide it. When you're ready to graduate into the next phase, you then cast the vision for that phase. But never do you try to cast the overall vision for the whole thing, because it takes a very special person to be able to track with that train of thought.
Excellent. I also think one of the pieces of advice I'm going to take away, well, two. One is, you know, simple solutions still work.
Yes.
But the other thing is, you just mentioned it, you know, that you're a patient person. And, you know, we often have clients who are like, oh, I want this latest and greatest thing. And all of a sudden, the project's gone off track because they want this new thing. And, you know, Leigh and I think one of our greatest flaws, I think our clients love it, but our greatest flaws, we give them what they want. And sometimes we should do a better job of saying, we will give you that later. You know, that's not necessarily right now.
What they need. Yeah.
There's an old web mantra. I don't remember where I heard it for the first time, but the whole philosophy of everyone wants it fast, good, and cheap, but you only get to pick two.
Yeah. Right.
And so that's perfect. And I remember a very specific conversation after I had only been at the College of Education for 3 weeks, and I listened to the guy on my team talk to some clients. I finally went into his office one time after he hung up the phone, and I said, okay, just real quick, these are some things we need to eliminate from our vocabulary. Yes. Anything you want, and whatever it takes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we need to stop saying those things to people, because the truth is, when we get into this redesign project, we're going to be saying no to a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. And so you really have to draw those boundaries and try with everything you have to keep the scope wrangled. And then that's where the communication comes in, and you have to set the scope and make the agreements, get the signatures you need and the approvals in writing, so that when someone tries to invent a new feature later on, you say, sorry, we can do that later, but this is the scope we're working with, and this is what we're moving towards right now.
Absolutely. Awesome. Thanks, Daniel.
Man, thank y'all. This has been a hoot.
Yeah. So, but before we finish up, we do have our rapid fire 10 question games so our listeners can get to know you a bit better. Are you ready?
Let's practice that decisiveness right now.
Question one, Android or iOS?
iOS.
If you were stranded on a desert island and can only bring three things, what would you bring?
My wife, my MacBook, and a satellite Wi-Fi connection.
What's your favorite TV show?
Big Bang Theory.
What's your favorite dessert?
Pecan pie.
What profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
Oh, attempt? Man, that's a unique spin on the question. Attempt. The only thing on my mind is professional tennis player. I love tennis.
Oh, interesting.
Mm. What about a profession you would not like to try?
Oh, teaching.
You work for a university.
That's a total lie. I actually love educating people and love teaching people. I don't know where that came from. My wife is a preschool teacher. I'm not fond of kids, but teaching I love to do. Love to teach.
What's the latest article or blog post you read?
Oh, I'm a big fantasy football guy, so the latest injury updates, Jamal Charles. Ankle injury, ACL injury is terrible.
Yeah, my boyfriend was complaining about that this weekend. He's a big Chiefs fan. If you could have a superpower, what would it be?
Oh, man, I've thought about this so many times, and I think I have to settle on reading people's minds. I always want to be the guy in the elevator with people speaking another language, and they don't think I understand what they're saying, and then as I get off the elevator, I say something to them that lets them know that I know.
I love that. What music do you like to work to?
Classical, right? Isn't that the baby psychology thing now? Classical music stimulates brain activity. It definitely does for me.
Hmm. All right, last question. Cats or dogs?
Cats.
Awesome.
Although I think I secretly love dogs. I just don't, it's not outward.
That's all the time we have for today. Thank you for joining.
Thank you both. This has been wonderful.
In case our listeners want to follow up with you, where can they find you online?
Yeah, you can find me. My website is fallowtown.com. But of course, as with most people these days, hit me up on Twitter at Daniel Fowler.
Awesome. This was a great conversation. Thanks again, Daniel.
Thank you so much.
Control Click is produced by Bright Umbrella, a web services agency obsessed with happy clients. Today's podcast would not be possible without the support of this episode's sponsor. Thank you, Visual Chefs.
We'd also like to thank our partners, Arcus Tech, DevOT, and EE Insider.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. If you want to know more about Control Click, make sure you follow us on Twitter at Control Clickcast or visit our website, controlclickcast.com. And if you liked this episode, please give us a review on Stitcher or iTunes or both.
Don't forget to tune in to our next episode when we will talk about native versus web mobile design with Bren Lanier. Be sure to check out our schedule on our site, controlclickcast.com/schedule, for more upcoming topics.
This is Leah Alcantara
and Emily Lewis
signing off for Control Clickcast. See you next time.
Cheers.